Welcome back to Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for May 28th, 2025. But really, before we jump into that, I was wondering if you've been paying attention, Tom, to a lot of like the geopolitical activities happening between Pakistan and India, which we'll be talking. I have one source just going to kind of touch on that a little bit. That's interesting today. But also, I don't know if you saw the ramp up with Ukraine and Russia conflicts growing. And there was some kind of alluding to there's a lot of cyber activity happening between like all the other NATO supporters in Russia potentially going on. So I don't know if you saw any of that. It might be interesting what comes up in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's hard to predict sometimes, but a lot of times you can kind of see, I mean, historically, anytime there's these kind of conflicts, man, there's a lot of pointing. You can almost predict it with absolute certainty that, hey, these guys are going to go after somebody, especially the big nation states that we're constantly talking about where threat actors are supported from, right? So your Russia, your Iran, North Korea, China's, you know, you tend to see that a lot in those predictions, right? So if there's any conflict around those, you could be absolutely sure there's going to be a cyber piece, right?
Yeah, it's always good. Like I make it a point when I know things like that are going on to try to like keep my ear to the ground, because when there is information around attacks and things like that, there's usually a lot to learn and a lot that gets disclosed as well.
So. Yeah, in a good way. And we've done it in the past too, right? It's a good way to kind of establish a bit of prioritization around different activities, you know, whether you want to do some different hunting, net new hunting, detection building, you know, or you want to just keep your CTI team kind of focused at a certain direction because you might get caught in the crossfire, right? Good way to anticipate.
Well, cool. So what do you got for us to start out today?
All right, starting today, I have an article from Trend Micro titled TikTok Videos Promise Pirated Apps and Instead Deliver Vidar and SteelC Info Stealers. So Trend Research uncovered a new social engineering campaign using TikTok to deliver Vidar and SteelC. The attack is pretty simple, likely AI generated, but it just uses a video and instructs users to execute a PowerShell command, which disguises the software activation steps, you know, a bit of a click fix style social engineering, if you will. So fascinated by this. I'll probably say that about 3 or 4 times throughout the episode today, but so, you know, kind of a quick overview. So the TikTok videos promoted a free versions of popular software. So like Spotify Premium, Office 365, and so on. And in the video, they instruct users to run a PowerShell command directly from their systems. And then those commands, as those commands would, pull down scripts that lead to malware execution. So a couple quick, just small pointers on Vidar and SteelC, since they are packaged in here with this. So Vidar is primarily focused typically at, things like browser credentials and cookies, autofill data, session files on Telegram session files, and then it'll generally target cryptocurrency wallets as well. Some of the general indicators for them, common stuff that we tend to see. So command line usage of curl, invoke web request, or if it's admin, file processes from the browsers or PowerShell that'll spawn run DLL 32 or Red Server 32. And then some of the other stuff is, you know, you can see unusual outbound connections to, you know, fast flux domains or, you know, non-standard domains like .xyz or things like that. And then Vidar will typically write in the file system under app data, local temp or app data roaming. These are not necessarily not new, just kind of a summary for them. And then when you look at SteelC, you're looking at a lot of things where you see C2 communication, often using like Discord as a webhook or Telegram bots. They will sometimes abuse system.net.web client or system.net.http client for exfiltration. They have something that we talk about ad nauseum, and we will always continue to, because it's one of the easiest low hanging fruit pieces there. But as far as SteelC establishing persistence, you know, they go to the typical route of editing the register run keys, leveraging scheduled tasks, and then LNK files and setting them for execution at startup. And then some of the evasion techniques DLC would use, they typically would masquerade as a legitimate app, right? So it's kind of falling in line with what these videos are showing. So, you know, trying to pretend to be Spotify or an updater for Microsoft Office, things like that. And DLC has also been observed being able to execute shellcode and use process hollowing to help be stealthy. So, you know, a couple of hunting notes here in the article that was put out. One of the ones that are easy to flag, so identifying command line activity where you would see the invoke expression or the IEX and then the IRM calls, which would be the invoke web request. When you see those calls together, it could be an easy start to look for. Certainly, this could be done for legitimate use from like an admin perspective as example, but it should, I would think, be generally rare enough to identify suspicious activity versus what you would expect. But yeah, overall, I thought this was worth talking about. So people kind of knew this was happening, you know, really for awareness, but it's still very wild to me that the way ClickFix is having a way to be successful. I'm not surprised to see that this avenue would be used necessarily with this style of approach of like a social engineering method, but man, it's crazy. Maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just, maybe I'm putting my head on it a little too much, but it's crazy that this is as effective as it is. But, you know, leveraging TikTok, having a video to tell you how to infect your machine is wild.
I know.
But yeah, what did you think about this, Scott?
You know, it's interesting because it's clear that it's an effective approach, this whole click fix thing, getting people to do things. And I feel like one of the reasons why, the more and more I think about it, is just how people are struggling to identify when it does happen. Not so much maybe how susceptible people are to it. That makes sense. Because usually those are the two biggest deterrents, right? Either people don't fall for it, or it's really hard to detect. Easy to detect. If I want to keep things on the same side, right? So attackers will do it if they can trick people or they can't get caught, right? So there's that, but you know, the use of the, you know, social media stuff, obviously that down the target base is different. You're not really going after corporation type stuff. You're really going after users in general. So this kind of reminds me of when, you know, you used to play games back in the day and you try to download crack so that you can play without the CD and stuff like that. And a lot of times some of that stuff will start getting bundled with malware for the same kind of purposes. There wasn't a lot of online banking and things as much back then. So there wasn't the same types of stuff. But obviously, there's more things to steal that are monetary, have some monetary worth or whatever. So it's just interesting to kind of like see some of the motivations being leveraged. They even mentioned that some of the videos they even think were like AI video created, which I think is also interesting just because it just alleviates a lot of the burden to create videos. That's like going to be the one challenge with like the social media video run, right? Is the time consuming this to make a decent looking video? Well, obviously the AI really shortcuts that and if they're able to leverage that, because it's not like the video has to be almost really of any substance. It could just be something that looks catchy, and then you have in the details and comments what it is, and you know, kind of get your plugs that way. So that was just kind of an interesting take. I mean, everything else you said about things to pay attention to, look for and stuff like that, I thought were really interesting. Obviously, if you have web proxy type traffic, or you know, you're able to see that. In this case, you know, if you're a home user, you're not. But in organizations where maybe someone could potentially be affected by this, you can look for that. You know, anything with domains, and then, you know, it's all ending in some sort of a PowerShell like PS1 at the end of that whole URI. Worth paying attention to. The other thing I thought was interesting was it's very clear that people use TikTok on their, you know, PCs. Right, I would just assume it's all phone driven, so this wouldn't even be that effective. So that kind of surprised me as well. Yeah,
and that was interesting. Interesting thought I had kind of coming out of this too. I wonder, apps like that, when things like this go up, you know, are they considering them? Are they flagging them? Are they looking at them? Are there takedown methods from, you know, companies, you know, from their side, right? Like, do they sniff these things out easy, or is it easy for a threat actor to spin up accounts to do this? And that's a curiosity that I plan on digging into a little more just to understand.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, it's like, you know, security is everyone's responsibility. And I feel like if you're gonna offer a service, you almost have to have that baked in, or you know, if it gets bad enough and someone does something bad enough with your service, it's enough to hurt your business too, you know? So there is some risk management you have to kind of do there.
For sure. I'd loosely argue that social media bucks that trend a little bit, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So
what do you got next, Lester?
Yeah, I'm going to jump into another. It's kind of Click Fix related, but it's also a really interesting resource. But I actually found it by just kind of looking through news-based articles. And it was an article on Medium, and it was titled Velvet Solima APTA Adversary Simulation. So I was like, well, what is this? Like, why is it referred to as adversary simulation? Well, basically, I'll explain what it is here in a second, but there is a GitHub repo. It's a long handle name, so I'll have to grab that in the comments or links below when you guys listen to the podcast. But it's APT attack simulation. I'm sure if you just search for that on GitHub, you'd probably find it as well. But basically, this user has a repo where he's looked at common attacks based on, you know, CTI research from Chinese APTs, North Korean APTs, Russian APTs, and try to build simulations of those style of attacks to basically see how they work and then potentially maybe see how your tools or other things you can do to kind of help study and understand. And so this one that this article specifically picked up on was a Click Fix. And this was one of the ones where basically North Korea at, I think it was earlier this year, January, where they were basically using a PDF attachment that led to a link that was a fake CAPTCHA that also would try to set up basically a fake Google Meet. And they would launch a reverse PowerShell that way. The big thing here that was really interesting was just, I was thinking about, because ClickFix is getting so prominent and you're doing the run command, right? Like you're doing the Windows R, that's how they're picking that up. And then what's really hard with the execution chain, when you look at that, is that's going to be explore.exe running PowerShell, which is really hard to root out because that's like any user activity is going to be driven by that. And then I got to thinking, you know, it's one thing when you launch PowerShell from Explorer and now you have the PowerShell window or ICE or whatever you're running there, and then you type in and you use PowerShell as a user. I do think it's interesting when you have follow-on command line arguments off of PowerShell. So commonly, if you look at command line when things get executed, you know, you'll see the path of the executable usually. Sometimes it might just be the executable and then the command line that follows it. So in this situation, you'd almost look for anything that's after the PowerShell path or PowerShell.exe, if there's anything that follows that. So some tools will let you use, you know, regex or pattern-based things to help assess what that is. But I think that'd be a great way to actually attack the ClickFix thing, right? You know, you've got Explorer basically launching PowerShell with commands. It seems like that's every single ClickFix behavior, at least on the Windows side. So I was kind of curious what you thought about that approach in general, since, you know, obviously Click Fix has become such a popular thing, but I feel like the execution is always the same.
No, I mean, I like that idea. I mean, things, I wouldn't expect that to be really typical, right? So if you're tracking that, I mean, I'm thinking, and I'm generally curious how it would look, right? So if you see the, yeah, I mean, you're really just looking for it spawned by Explorer. And yeah, just like you said, sorry, I'm thinking out loud, I'm processing that.
Yeah.
Literally on
the fly. No, it's like, I've seen, like, you know, if you have PowerShell running from a scheduled task, it's still like services or SVC host kicking it off. Or I've seen where, like, if PowerShell command line stuff's run from like a process is doing, like a tool or something is doing something, it usually still originates from the tool, not Explorer. So just seeing it naked from Explorer running PowerShell with follow on commands, I feel like, I mean, this is why threat hunting is great, is there might be some noise in there, but I feel like there would be not enough noise to not make that effective.
Right. Or, yeah, I mean, at least be a relatively useful hunt, right?
Yeah. So I guess I'm going to have to explore. I'll do some testing on that just to see from whatever data we have. But I think that might be at least a fun approach to, because like I said, if we're going to talk about Click Fix every single week, I'd like to have like some sort of solution to that, you know?
Yeah, eventually. Yeah. Why were we talking about it? You know, I liked the you know, kind of the source here from this article. This is something that, you know, we don't, I don't think we necessarily talk about at length, even though it's something we pretty much do all the time. But I know in past career moments, the idea to be able to simulate attacks is, it's not talked about enough, I don't think, from the general security side. What do you think? Like, I know my experience is just my experience, but typically when you see stuff, and you know, you talk about threat hunting, you talk about doing all these things, and we actively live it, right? So we're testing, we're doing all this stuff all the time. You know, things that we promote through our, you know, through the, you know, our side of the house, always kind of come with those emulations. But it's just cool to have another resource to say, hey, here's something you can use to go out in your environment and try to emulate it to help you kind of know what you see, show the visibility, test your folks, your processes, all the things. Man, I love stuff like this.
Yeah, I think it's important, because if you look at, like, sometimes one of the, a lot of the key things people will ask interviews or look for from like a seasoned security person is like, well, what incidents have you dealt with, right? And that's a tough question sometimes, because not everyone plays all the same roles in an incident. They may be around and assist, but not really be in the main part of incident response. Sometimes that goes to like dedicated people. So even if you work in security, you might not have too many hands in that. And you can't really control like when incidents happen, you know? So, you know, to rely on that experience, which is a solid experience, if you go through an incident, you learn so much. I feel like you can still get experience if you can simulate attacks and do certain types of emulations, so you at least know how it feels or what it looks like, you know, within your environments, you know, with it, with your tools, all that type of stuff. So I think that part is really good, and you can almost speak to that as like, how many incidents have you dealt with? Like, well, I have experience with all these types of attacks because I do these types of things, and I've seen this type of data, and I've solved these types of problems by doing this process. I think that's a really strong conversation within those conversations. But yeah, I think not enough people do it. And then sometimes people get too focused on like, did I successfully see an attack occurred, and not really pay attention to all the steps and nuances, right? Like, I feel like I remember, you know, we almost celebrate if there's a pen test that we caught them, and you'd almost forget, well, what are all the things that we missed? What are all the things we did see? What are all the things that could be better? Like, there's more to it than just saying we found it, you know?
Yeah. And it goes to a lot of things. I mean, I know from just my experience, we used to use that kind of methodology, you know, the attack simulation or the emulation, and throw it at the team in ways that provided a bit of that kind of chaos, right? Because anytime there is an incident, there's almost this like natural wave of chaos that goes along with it. Even if you're super by the book and have a great plan and everybody's hand out their roles, there's still a level of chaos that's involved, right? And the only way it's, I don't know, maybe it's like that, you know, the idea of being in live fire is going to get you a little more attuned to being able to react to it when it comes and just get you better off. So it's always cool. And it's cool to see another resource to help potentially navigate that water.
That's very cool.
All right. Cool. Jumping into the next one. So I have a little article from domaintools.com. It's titled Inside a Venom Rat Malware Campaign. So this article discusses the recent Venom Rat malware campaign that highlights the tactics employed by the threat actors to distribute their remote access Trojan or the rat. One of the kind of key points, and I'll expand on this probably down the talking points here, but the distribution method, the threat actors created a fraudulent website, bitdefender-download.com. Mimicking almost exactly Bitdefender's official site to distribute malicious software. And looking at the samples given, this was very spot on to the Bitdefender's page. So in the article, they show, you know, the legit versus the bad actors version. Very legitimate looking, very easily able to fool, you know, whatever prospective victims or targets that it was going after. And going through the process of this social engineering and falling for going to that site, clicking the buttons, doing the things, you would end up with a malware bundle, a nice little trio of stuff that would be downloaded via zip file and contained a EXE called Store Installer EXE. And it included the Venom Rat, which is the remote access Trojan that would help give persistent access to the system. And then you'd get a nice little version of Storm Kitty, which is primarily an info stealer. And then another malware, which is called Silent Trinity, which is basically a post-exploitation malware. So the rat would establish itself and then communicate to C2 at various IPs, but over port 4449. And then some of the other kind of malware characteristics you've seen, the Venom Rat would also, which is notably derived from the Quasar Rat, if anyone's familiar with that. But in enabling that remote access, but also key logging and then playing a part in data exfiltration. And then Storm Kitty primarily focused on extracting sensitive information. So going after the credentials, the wallet data, things like that. And then Silent Trinity would be utilized for executing those post-exploitation tasks, you know, kind of establishing itself, maintaining stealthy access, and basically gaining that foothold, the position for additional actions. When I'm thinking about threat hunting from this article, so I'm taking a different approach on this one, mainly because the depth of stuff that's there, you know, when I want to see this kind of activity, I'm going to kind of talk about the unstructured land of things a little bit. So looking, you know, if I am concerned about this activity, and this isn't necessarily a small undertaking, but depending on your environment, what tools are in your realm that you could be potentially convinced to fall for a imitating domain, looking for that. So, you know, an unstructured hunt, looking for access to domains that resemble those legitimate antivirus providers, right? So if you are a Bitdefender shop and you can compile a list of, you know, abstract things or find a way to regex it into your query or whatever you're looking for, anything that's not the expected one that would might resemble that, there's soft ways to go about that. I've done that before in the past myself. Usually you find some pretty cool results. And then network and traffic analysis, not something we talk about a lot on the show necessarily, but there are things you can do. And, you know, watching for outbound connections to, you know, IPs over unusual ports, maybe you have a list of known IPs you can track that way, things like that. But, you know, short item here, but I always find it interesting when a bad actor campaign starts with such a convincing social engineering attempt, Scott. Maybe it's just like me being an old dog now or whatever. I don't know. I don't know how it fits, but this used to be the kind of things that I would worry about from a social engineering side of the house, like something that was so convincing that the phishing training and all the common things that are talked to people about avoiding these kinds of traps, stuff that's this convincing tends to just ignore all that, right? Like, and at least in my mind, you know, the other side of things, I would have imagined that when someone you don't know tells you to, you know, I don't know, like it's kind of that comparable, because we've been talking about cliff fix a lot. And when I look at something like this, and I'm not saying it's like the best thing ever, but it's very solid as far as the landing spot to get people and to fish people to gain that access versus tell somebody on a video, hey, go run these random commands and copy and paste this stuff in your run window. And it's like, this is where I get hung up sometimes, because it's mind blowing to me, because I would expect that your common phishing training would already have told you that click fix style should be a red flag. Whereas this one is like, clearly they're spending the time and effort to make it look so convincing that you're not going to be able to see those little red flags in identifying that kind of activity. But yeah, you know, what are your thoughts here, Scott?
I'm going to touch on the few things that I would always be paying attention to if I have the data. And if I'm looking at web proxy data and I see things directly calling out to IPs, that's always a red flag. And then if there's any files that are just EXEs that are specifically downloaded, I would probably pay attention to those too, but I might group those based on like the domain or something, because obviously there's going to be some domains where you download an installer file and you kind of can identify those and pick those out. But then you have like weird domains it would be worth looking at. But what I hate about all this is, you know, we have a security control in place to actually help protect for this and other types of attacks like this. And it's using PKI inserts. But what I hate is no one really ever uses them effectively. Like, people use them primarily for making sure websites are secure, right? So that you can do encrypted traffic, because we do banking, we do other things that we want to be able to say, hey, we, you know, we need that. But the other thing it also does is validates that you are talking to who you think you're talking to, right? If it's a signed cert site, but then also software being signed, right? So if that EXE isn't signed by something that's trustworthy or something that's bit, you know, Defender related, I feel like it's a space that hasn't really matured enough for like the PKI infrastructure. And what I hate is because it's developers and web-based folks that need to be like responsible for it, not necessarily security folks, there's these blatant holes in it everywhere. Like, it's like an all or nothing solution, right? Everybody has to do it, and then it works really well. And if only a few people do it, then it kind of works. Because even, you know, a lot of security tools will give you the option to say only run, you know, stuff that's signed. But the problem is there's plenty of things that aren't signed that need to run, so they don't ever use that at control. So I just bring that up because it just makes me think of that, like these types of attacks, when they can look like a close to similar domain, they, you know, use, you know, EXEs that are supposed to look like something. It always pains me. I'm like, man, you know, like, what would be the solution for this? Like, well, it's obvious. It's, you know, good CA authority cert infrastructure, ways to validate that in an automated fashion where tools can do it, but tools will never invest in that if people aren't actually, you know, doing best practice. I mean, they have the same thing, right, with how you can do, like, I think it's like DKIM and whatever else for email. You know, you have to have the certain things within DNS records for yourself, and then people can't basically spoof you for phishing. And it's a great technology, but it's like one of those things where if it's either all or nothing, if people don't do it, then people don't enable it because it breaks other things. So, yeah, it just kind of makes me kind of regretfully think about where that is and where it should be.
And it's a fascinating, it's almost like, you know, it'll be cool to do some level of study. It's like, I'm a documentary guy, so I love like when stuff comes out where they put all the data together and give you kind of the scope of the story. Like, I know there won't be one, but my brain imagines one when it's talking about these kinds of things where the actors are going so far to try to be convincing. And then you compare that with the way technology is coming about, the leveraging of AI, the bad actors that we've talked about before, standing up these really sophisticated phishing as a service tools, and how easy when you can get this close to replicating what you're trying to do. And I have to imagine the success rate is much higher there than it is in ClickFix, but the ClickFix thing still continues to be evolving and prevalent somehow. It's just mind boggling how those two things compare them to each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We just got to do better at following through with our security solutions so we don't leave holes behind. So when we address new problems, we're not always dealing with every problem, you know?
Yeah. But the way it seems to be trendy, and maybe I'm downplaying the ClickFix thing a little too much, but I feel like the way we're going, the next step is we're just going to hand people USBs and they're going to randomly plug them in everywhere. I don't know. It's wild. All right. Well, what do you got last for us, Scott?
So this last one I thought was interesting. So we kind of chatted a little earlier when we talked about kind of the state of the geopolitical side of the house, and, you know, India and Pakistan are kind of at ends with each other, right? So there was an article from SecRight, SEQ, and it was the Operation Sindoor, Anatomy of a Digital Siege. And this was interesting. So there's kind of like a sub article I'll bring into this as well, but this is kind of the overview of what's going on. They're basically looking at the Operation Sindoor, right? And it's involving APT activity, but also hacktivist operations and how they actually like came together to do this like coordinated type of attack against a lot of the like India's infrastructure from like government, let's see, telecom, finance, healthcare, education, like pretty much across the board, right? And, you know, one of the big coordinated attacks they really talked about was one on like May 7th. They talked about how there's like the specific DDoS, and then they had Islamic Hacker Army were doing the Ministry of Defense, causing disruptions there, and then they hit the IMB, information broadcasting. Then there was another DDoS wave on another set of targets. And then there was a massive attack on, and it was over the span of, you know, a few hours, right? But it was like hitting multiple targets. But they looked at all the hacktivist teams. You know, they have teams in Europe that were joining in with that, one in Africa, you know, a few in Asia, and then obviously the Middle East, all kind of coming together. And they kind of show the timeline, like where activity is like ramping up more, like, you know, Operation Cinder was relatively quiet May 5th and then ramped up and then really peaked around, you know, between the 10th and the 11th. And so it's just kind of interesting to see, like, you know, sitting on the sideline and watching cyber operations when conflicts break out, and also seeing how there's people that maybe want to help participate, and cyber is one of those things where you don't have to be part of the government or the military or whatever to potentially step up for that. So, you know, from May 7th to the 10th, they confirmed there's over 650 DDoS or defacement events that occurred. They had 35, you know, plus hacktivist groups that were actually involved, which is a lot of activity if you think about just like kind of coordination and the communication there. They even saw 7 newly emerged groups, so that maybe they got stood up because of the conflict, which I thought was really fascinating. They had a couple resources that kind of directed towards more technical stuff. And so I pivoted to one of them that I thought was really interesting. And it's under the same, you know, SecRight blog, but it's titled Umbrella of Pakistani Threats, Converging Tactics of Cyber Operations Targeting India. And this was interesting because it just shows like you have a ton of different groups working together, right? So there's a ton of different tool sets that are going to be leveraged. And in this, I'm not going to hit every single technical detail, but what was fascinating was like the number of different rats that are being leveraged. And then also one of the things that called out was, you know, you can even see where there's some of the same infrastructure is being utilized as well. And I thought that was kind of an interesting point because we saw the same thing happen when Russia and Ukraine, then when their conflicts were starting and cyber operations were ramping up, you saw a lot of reuse of infrastructure. And this goes to show that infrastructure isn't just sitting and waiting, I guess, in a lot of cases, because it is pretty easy to spin it up. But when you have an operation you need to go down, it kind of the human nature makes sense to, hey, we need attacks. Here is our, you know, our infrastructure we can use right now. And as, you know, operations or commands or orders come down the chain, we just have to execute. You're going to possibly do a lot of reuse there. And in this case, they did as well, where different rats were actually converging on the same infrastructure. So the rats were using the Sidewinder loader. And Sidewinder loader, the one thing that's notable about that is the way it kind of persists is it uses the typical three things that you commonly see in Windows, either the registry run keys to start up shortcut in the startup directories, or schedules tasks running VB script, which is mean you'd have like schedule tasks running W script, essentially the execution chain. But you know, that would have either pull an action rat was one of the rats, Gator rat, then reverse rat. But what was interesting was reverse rat was actually called upon a lot, and they had different ways where it was pulled down. So you had the Sidewinder loader, but they also were able in another campaign, they use MSI exec, with the arguments, /Q/I, which basically says quietly pull from this location and install whatever's there, remotely, which is good to look for in general, but they also try to obfuscate MSI exec. So they did the caret symbol, the symbol above the 6 on the keyboard in between every character, which doesn't just like Windows doesn't, it just ignores that character. So it's a way where you can like break up names of things even, cause it's not really a valid character. And that's how they were running that. And then they had another campaign where for the reverse rat specifically, where they use PowerShell and invoke web requests with the execution bypass, the hidden windows and things like that we've seen. So all very, very common techniques there. They use Crimson Rat. They didn't touch on a lot of things about Crimson Rat. just that it was being leveraged. And then Side Copy Rat was another one. And that was interesting because it used HTA execution. So basically it had a shortcut file that once it was open, because they use a lot of phishing, right, to lead into all of this. You'd open up the shortcut file, it would launch MSHTA because it's going to then actually run an HTA file. But it's running it from a remote server. So seeing MSHTA and then a remote location, and then ironically, we've talked about it before, a lot of the HTA files that were being leveraged were just single character named HTA files. So a little different, because maybe we'll pull those down into a temporary directory. So you might see the files locally, potentially. I'm not really sure about that. But if you have web proxy stuff, you can pick up on single character stuff at the end of the URI with HTA as well. I've been talking about a lot of web proxy logs today. So it's a log that I feel like sometimes is underrated. But the thing I really liked was we talked about a campaign that involved a bunch of groups, right? So, you know, they mentioned, you know, 35 plus hacktivist groups. They even had APTs in the mix. And then they have all these different malware tools, right? And the big thing that my big takeaway was, is the key things I mentioned, like the technical things about like how things were loaded or installed or executed, are the things we talk about on a weekly basis. So it just shows how effective it is understanding behaviors, and also understanding, like, you can see how much they're shared, right? Like, granted, I think IOCs might get you somewhere on this because of this short and aggressive campaign where there's a lot of reuse of infrastructure. But, you know, if all these groups use their own infrastructure, then the IOC list would be even bigger for things to monitor for versus looking at the behaviors that we described that are easy to identify, easy to hunt for, and will help protect you against 35 plus different groups, right? That's a strong conversation piece. I like that. So yeah, what were your thoughts?
So the first thing that I thought when I read this was, I had a flashback in my brain to the Hackers movie, right? I was like, oh, they're hacking the Gibson. Like, it's just everybody kind of coming together and doing this coordinated attack. And
oh, yeah.
But, you know, thinking through it more, we talk constantly about, you know, the big APT groups, or, you know, the new and hot ones that are out there being talked about, or had a, you know, a glorified flag planting attack or things like that. But yeah, we really kind of don't talk about the kind of hacktivist side much. I think in general, it's felt like over the last few years, that's not really something that you hear of too often. Mm-hmm. But all things considered, like you had mentioned, you know, a lot of the tactics and techniques are so common now that they're not, you don't consider a lot of the basic stuff advanced to where hacktivism can be more deadly. And then you have this coordinated attack when they're pairing up against a common goal. It's both. I want to be careful on how I say this. It's encouraging to see that kind of coordination, not necessarily what they're doing and what they're going for, right? But the other part too is we talk about the different tools and where the technology has gone. So whether it's the leveraging of AI to be able to do things, or all these as a service offerings from bad actors that are there, it makes these hacktivists more ready to get in the front line, right? It's almost like they're a pre-armed militia in some cases, if you kind of read it like that. So I just found that incredibly interesting. I mean, that was the biggest takeaway I had here, was thinking about, man, like we talked about in the show opening, when you're looking to predict things, is it something you have to consider for the potential barrage? And I don't even know how you would, right? So we're talking spaghetti against the whiteboard right now. But if you were to think, and you're in that situation and you're a defender, how would you consider a coordinated kind of attack like that? I feel like you'd be getting, you know, potentially be getting hit from every side of the house.
Like, yeah, it's a hard thing to manage, but especially with disruption, right? So you're talking about like DDoS, mm-hmm. Like you're kind of like, there's a storm you kind of have to weather in part of that. But when they get hooks with rats and things like that, that's where you really want to be vigilant. Because you just don't want that persistent access. That's a big, and so yeah, I think, you know, and then you got to think about, okay, well, let's say we do threat hunt for these types of attacks. You're not going to threat hunt for the disruption stuff. That's just going to happen. But not getting distracted by all the disruption, so you take the time to maybe hunt more frequently or more often, you know, To be more proactive, I think is important. And then, you know, if you know, you know, something to pay attention to, I would think too, with the types of attacks and the time of day, almost like you want to kind of maybe plan your hunts when the morning starts, when the evening's wrapping up, maybe one in the late evening, because you think it's going to be after hours and maybe they'll think they have, you know, so like where people might operate, you know, in times of that. Or you see a bunch of denial service stuff all of a sudden hitting, maybe that's a trigger, like, hey, we need to kick off these hunts, you know, in the next 10 or 15 minutes and whatever that is, so you can get back to the activity. Like stuff like that might be something to consider as well.
It's a 35 plus hacktivist groups that were involved, including the seven that were new, that they kind of bulleted in that article. It was just super interesting. Going back to that whole emulation thing, you know, you talk about getting hit by one given actor, right, with maybe a targeted attack that's very sophisticated. But we talked about it just a little bit ago, like the chaos that would occur, you know. I don't know, to me now I'm over here thinking like, how could I prepare my team? How could I get my folks ready? What kind of emulations can I run to throw that much chaos at them and see how they handle it? You know, it's interesting.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I think that kind of wraps up what we have so far. So, but one mention before we close out, I will be doing a threat hunting management workshop. This will be June 18th. It's about structuring collaboration across teams. So there's been a lot of conversations around how do you threat hunt teams, intel teams, security operations, how can they work better together? And, you know, there's some silos and hurdles that we've heard in the past that I kind of just want to talk about, pitch some ideas, look at some things. So, like I said, that'll be June 18th from 12 to 12:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next time. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of May 28th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.